Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Matt Spaeth, and with me today is my co-host, Carol Gravet.
Hello, Matt.
Hi, Carol. Susan Wright is not joining us today, but we are pleased to introduce a new series that we're having on Food Integrity Now, and that is on organic gardening and growing your own food. We're really excited for this because for a long time we've focused on the activism part and alerting people about GMOs, stuff like that, and now we want to focus on what you can do for your own self in growing your own food. And we're pleased to have as our special guest today, Evan Folds of Progress Earth. Evan is he's the founder of Progress Earth and a prolific writer for Maximum Yields and Urban Gardening. He's joining us to help us make the most of what you have in your growing situation, whether you're in a city, urban environment, or even in suburbia, whatever you can do to take charge of your own food. So Progress Earth is it's an interesting company with setting its own standards and taking a different vision for what a company can be. So Evan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks very much, Matt. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about Progress Earth and how you founded it and what the vision for the company is.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head where, you know, we're really trying to set our own standards. One of the things that I've recognized for a long time is that, you know, there's not really morality in business. And that's not to say that, you know, all business is bad, but it's really a race to, you know, the bottom line, more or less. So I met a biodynamic farmer named Steve Storch maybe 10 years ago now. And the same month that there was a lot of other serendipitous things that happened during this time, but about the same month I read a book called Secrets of the Soil. And I can honestly say that that book changed my life. It's just kind of one of those things where everything hits you at once and you kind of find yourself in a different setting, so to speak, and you kind of realize what you need to do. And I started a gardening store called Progressive Gardens, you know, within that year, and been doing that for about 9 years. And from my relationship with this farmer, developed a wholesale platform that kind of sputtered along for a while. That being Progress Earth. And maybe within the last year, we've really kind of stepped up our game and really, you know, found that a lot of the distributors out there in the gardening universe didn't really have the wherewithal and the perspective to really sell and distribute the products the way that we saw that they needed to. It can kind of be a mouthful and, you know, a lot of the turnover and sales reps and that kind of thing. So we really made a decision to revamp our company. We now sell directly to the public. We also sell through a dealer network, and we kind of became a distributor rather than leaning on distributors themselves. So that's kind of a nutshell of how it came about in the creation.
Hey, go into your website. You got some really interesting products on there. Some things that definitely diverge from what people consider to be mainstream in the gardening world, and we think that's great. That's definitely what we're about on Food Integrity Now. Biodynamic farming. Let's give a little background on that for people that aren't really familiar with that.
Yeah, that's it's always an interesting time trying to make a connection with someone who's never heard of biodynamics. And believe me, I was in the same boat at one point myself. You know, I'm trained in biology. I have a biology and a religion degree in school. And you know, I like to say often that I didn't learn any of this stuff in school. And from my perspective, that's really the disconnect in regards to, you know, really how we teach ourselves about living systems and then actually how they operate. And I don't want to sit here and say I have it all figured out, but I'm very humble to the fact almost that we can't figure it all out. And that's a lot of what biodynamics is it really enters into the idea of, you know, humbling yourself that you can't, we'll put it this way, you can't know what a plant needs. Well, let me put it a different way. You might be able to figure out what a plant needs or has to have, but you really don't know what it wants. And that idea of kind of the anthropocentrism of people, and when we genetically modify foods and we feel like we're creating a value-added situation, we're really just screwing it all up. And, you know, biodynamics was really the first reaction to chemical farming. It was articulated by a man called Rudolf Steiner, who had influences on almost every facet of human civilization. And the fact that we don't, you know, collectively know about this guy is really a testament to how we indoctrinate ourselves, for lack of a better word, and how we teach ourselves about agriculture. You know, we teach ourselves that every farm is the same, and if you want 100 more acres of corn, you add 200 pounds of ammonium nitrate and call it good. And, you know, living systems don't work like that. You know, literally every lawn is different, and, you know, you should treat them that way. And that's really what we're trying to enter into with Progress Earth. So biodynamics is really you know, it's a holistic form of farming. It really, if you wanted to put it in a nutshell, it really looks at farm as a living organism, and even the earth as a living organism, or a grow room, or, you know, your backyard, or your greenhouse, or wherever you are. If you don't take into account not only the materialistic physical aspects of what you're working with, you know, the water, the fertilizers, the light frequencies, things like that, those are physical entities. But biodynamics really ties in the kind of the super sensible aspects of that, such as planting by celestial cycles, by the moon, when to harvest, when to plant seeds, you know, using different techniques. And really what defines biodynamics is the biodynamic preparations. And they are articulated by Steiner. He was asked, you know, what I find really profound about what Steiner put forward is he really didn't start it as a movement, you know, kind of how the organic movement has come into being and really, in my opinion, been sold out in modern times. The biodynamic method was really a reaction. Steiner, you know, from a spiritual context, never really tried to start a movement in and of itself. He was always triggered to offer his insight when someone asked him to do it. And back in the 1920s, right at the dawn of the, you know, Industrial Revolution, invention of synthetic fertilizers, many of these farmers over in Europe started to use them. And, you know, they were getting higher yields initially, and they started to feed this food that they were growing to their animals. And the animals started to experience cancers and all sorts of degenerative diseases that they'd never experienced before. And knowing Steiner being the you know, the resource that he was in terms of these aspects of life force and farming and agriculture, they asked him to give some lectures on it. And he gave 8 lectures that have become known as the Agriculture Course. And you can actually seek those lectures out under that title. It's a book now that's accumulation of these lectures. And I challenge anybody out there who has an interest in farming and agriculture, even if you don't adopt the principles that he put forward, just exposing yourselves to this different way of thinking and feeling about what you're doing is bound to have a profound effect on you know, how you grow your garden, how you look at your food, how you think about these things, which in the end, in my view, is really the most important thing. It's not about one certain act. It's really about the perspective you hold when you're carrying out the act that is really the most important aspect.
How much of an overlap or relationship does biodynamics have with permaculture?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I would say there's definitely overlap. You know, honestly, I'm sure there's a firm definition of permaculture somewhere, and I know there was founders and that kind of thing, but it's always tended to be somewhat of a loose concept to me. So, you know, I would have trouble squaring exactly, you know, where that overlap might be. But, you know, as in biodynamics, in terms of thinking as your farm as an organism, I mean, literally you have a certain number of cattle that create an amount of manure that regenerates the land. And in that respect, everything feeds in and of itself. And that's really a basis of permaculture. So in that respect, it's really a direct parallel. I think one difference is that biodynamics actually gives you some specific tools to use, whereas permaculture kind of leaves it at the concept and in my opinion, kind of tries to let you figure it out for yourself. And, you know, I'm also not aware enough about permaculture to speak to the spiritual aspect of it, but that's really the kind of the germ of biodynamics, is that, you know, we have this physical materialistic world that we live in, and it's relevant, don't get me wrong, but it all is born of a spiritual context. And if we can't respect that first and foremost, we're never going to be able to heal what it is that we're working with physically. One way that I heard biodynamics explained that really resonated with me is that, you know, conventional agriculture is drowning. Organic agriculture is treading water, and biodynamics is swimming where you want to go. And I think that really frames it quite properly, is that, you know, organic agriculture in the terms of what we've created for the certification aspect of it by the USDA now is really been hollowed out. And it really tends to be more the materialistic end of natural farming, not the whole enchilada. And unless you're really respecting that whole, you can do yourself a lot of damage. I mean, you can use really good organic fertilizers, you know, to keep it simple. Say you got too much calcium in your soil to begin with, and you're using an organic calcium-based product. Well, you can create imbalances in your soil that give you just as many weed issues and pest and disease issues as you would if using a conventional fertilizer. So it's not necessarily about organics only. It's about making sense of the whole. And really, that can sound very vague, but it's one of those things that once you've aligned your perspective to these things, you know, a lot of the complexity kind of falls into place, especially when you can have a result based on, you know, your newfound perspective. That's really, you know, I hope that we'll get into that, some of the nuts and bolts of this at some point, because the hardest part is the first step. You know, I mean, we have people that are reticent to get into growing their own food because they think they can screw it up. And, you know, the reality is you kind of have to screw it up a couple times before you figure it out. So that's something that we really strive to be a resource for, is really helping people take that first step.
Great. Well, let's get into that. I know so many people don't want to get into it because they just feel like it's too complicated and they don't understand how it works. So where do people start?
Well, you start with just an allocation of what you're working with. You know, if you have an apartment, you could have a hydroponic garden. There's all sorts of neat wall gardens and things like that you can take advantage of. One way that really helps to try to figure out what you want to do is just isolate one aspect of your diet. You know, I mean, for myself, you know, what really started me in terms, you know, because I got into this and saw I had a friend who had worked in a hydroponic store in Asheville, North Carolina, and it was funny because I was roommates with, I moved to the Virgin Islands after school trying to figure out what I was going to do, and my cousin gave me a room to stay in, and the roommate I ended up having worked with the biodynamic farmer I was telling you about. It was one of those serendipitous connections at that point. And about the same time, a friend of mine who had worked in the store in Asheville called me up knowing I had a biology degree and said, you know, you want to go into business together? And so I said, why not? Didn't know what else I was going to do. And the first venture we looked into kind of fell through, and we came back to Wilmington, North Carolina, where we had went to school, and there wasn't a hydroponic store within maybe 2-3 hours at the time. And this was 10 years ago. And so it was kind of a knee-jerk to start this gardening store. And I'd never grown a plant hydroponically in my life at that point. But immediately when I saw the concept of, you know, using a 20th of the water, you know, in terms of the recirculation of a hydroponic system, growing, you know, 10 to 20 times more produce per given area, I immediately made the connection that this technology was inevitable. You know, we're going to have to grow food where we are. We're going to have to grow it in a way that's more efficient, that respects really the energy that puts in. You need to get the same energy out. And we're completely imbalanced in modern society. I think everybody's pretty much come to that conclusion. So, you know, immediately making that connection, I got into it, and I really kind of, the first 2 to 3 years, taught myself everything that I knew writing a website for my retail store. And, you know, when I finally got to a point where I could breathe, and I said, all right, well, you know, I got to practice what I preach. And I really looked out, and I said, you know, well, what is it? I'm a big salad eater. I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat meat. So salad greens. So I started growing salad greens in little 10 by 20 seed flats. You know, just take a pack of mesclun greens, some potting soil, put it in there, sprinkle it over the greens and water it, you know, every other day. And, you know, I had a couple die on me, that kind of thing. And then eventually I just got a little strip light from my kitchen and I was growing salad greens and I had more than I could eat. And it was at that kind of what gave me the bug. You know, I really showed myself that I could do it. And once that happens, it's kind of a watershed and you kind of start looking everywhere with how can I start doing this for myself in different ways. And so I just suggest, you know, make an allocation of what it is that you eat, what you like to eat, and, you know, start some seeds. And really, the rest should take care of itself. So that would probably be the easiest way to get into it.
So that was the hook. You just started small, and then it just grew from there.
Yeah. I mean, that really is all there is to it. You have to give yourself that personal experience. I could speak to a similar situation with wheatgrass. It was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I'd always known that just by the way that we were putting ourselves out there with a gardening store, we have a lot of people that gravitate towards us in terms of health. And so that's a really rewarding thing about what I do. I'll never forget a conversation I had a couple of months ago with this woman. She had a stroke, and she was given pharmaceuticals by her doctor, by the expert. And the pharmaceutical side effects, she couldn't remember her daughter's name. And it was I was literally almost in tears talking to this woman about this situation. And she had taken it upon herself and, sought out microgreens and wheatgrass and, really, I don't want to say that she healed herself 100%, but she was living a normal life. She could remember her daughter's name, and she didn't have all these awful side effects. And that for her was enough to really believe in herself, and that's really what's so important about these things, is that we've set up a society that has these experts that tell you, how to go about, healing an illness and when it's really a crutch, or growing produce when it's really a crutch. And it's hard to get past that. And so that's what we try to set ourselves up to do. But, the wheatgrass thing, we have these sorts of people coming to us, and I'd always heard about it. And I decided to start doing it at my house. And I honestly set it up the same way I did the lettuce. I had a little strip light under the cabinet in my kitchen. And, I looked up some instructions, got some wheat berries, put them in play, juiced my first flat. And after the first week, I didn't get into it and have it consistent from the get-go, but I remember that first week juicing it every day, and then going into the next week, I could tell what I was missing something. And it's one of those things where, if you eat fast food for every meal and you take an all-organic diet and you start eating conscious food, you can feel the difference. But how do you really explain that to somebody? And that's really what's so hard to get over this collective hump in society. Of you can't talk people into these kinds of connections necessarily. You have to kind of really have that personal experience that really gives you the ability to say, I don't need someone to talk me into this. I know the value of it for myself. And that's just not something that readily comes from a conversation. So, wheatgrass is a very effective way to get into the feeling of conscious food. I think they say like 1 ounce is the equivalent of 2.5 pounds of vegetables in terms of the nutrient density, the enzyme content, et cetera. So you don't need a whole lot to have an experience. And, one way to think about that is name something in your diet that was alive within the last 5 to 10 minutes. And very few people can say that they do have, living food in their diet. And that's something that really has a major influence on the collective health of society.
I've seen
that.
Go ahead, Carol.
No, I said that's really well put. I've never really quite heard it put that way about having something live in your diet. When you think of going to the grocery store and you look around for the average person, what they're buying, it's not live food.
That's exactly right. Yeah,
I saw that.
It's easy to take that for granted too. So yeah, absolutely.
I saw a transformation in my friend who I hadn't seen him in a few months, and we were hanging out the other night, and he had just been had a meeting with Jeffrey Smith from the Institute for Responsible Technology, and mm-hmm. he told me about the changes he's made over the past few months, and I could completely see it in his face and in his body, in his energy level, in his clarity. And he was telling me how he was incorporating vegetables into his diet. He had, people tend to get to they get into these ruts of
right.
fast food and so much meat and dead food that they forget to incorporate the living foods into their diet. And it was amazing to see how much he had changed.
No, it's I've seen that many times myself, and that's probably the biggest jazz out of what I do, is when you can really see someone. I mean, not to be too profound about it, but I guess there's, in a certain way of looking at it, there's not really anything more profound that you could have, is you can really change people's lives, through this stuff. And, it's a way that I like to think about it. I've deal a lot with water and food, and there's a parallel there that, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, before industrialization, you know, all water was alive. You know, we didn't have fluoridation policies and putting chlorines and chloramines, and we don't have pharmaceuticals in our drinking water supplies, and we didn't have, you know, industrialization processes, filtration processes that really disrespect what water is. You know, if you don't allow water to take the path that it desires, you can deaden it, and it can't carry out its role. So the result is you can drink half your weight in ounces a day in water, which is recommended to do, and still be dehydrated. You're just irrigating your kidneys. You're not hydrating your cells. In a certain respect, your body doesn't have a mechanism to tell you when you're dehydrated, only when you're thirsty. And you're dehydrated well before, you know, there's a disconnect there in terms of what those mean. And in the same way, in regards to food, 100, 200 years ago, all food was alive. So if you think about it, you know, our taste buds and our ability to evaluate food has been completely turned on its head by modern food science. You know, we trick our taste buds in terms of the sweetness of things, in terms of engineering the taste of juices. I don't know if you ever heard of the book Squeezed. I think it's Alyssa Hamilton is the author, and she creates an expose of how, you know, we irradiate, which is the real word for pasteurization, and orange juice, and keep it in these, you know, huge million-gallon vats. Then we add coloring to it, and different companies actually hire perfume companies to re-engineer the taste, and that's why you have, you know, different tastes for different brands of orange juice, because they're engineered. And so, you know, we've done all of these audacious things in terms of changing food, and our bodies no longer have an ability to tell us what's good and what's bad for us. And in the end, you can eat a Big Mac and be full, but it's not nourishing you. So, you know, our bodies never evolved, so to speak, a mechanism to tell us when we're malnourished, only when we're calorically empty. And so you don't know you're malnourished until you get sick. And that's one of those things where, you know, like Carol, when you said that, it's absolutely true. It's like, you know, you can get to a point where you don't recognize what you're doing to yourselves. And you see that. We do a CSA through my retail gardening store, and a CSA is a community supported agriculture, and you basically hire the farmer and you pay a share up front, and we do, you know, $300 for 12 weeks, $25 a week, and you can come in every week and pick up a box of seasonal food. And it's just amazing to see, you know, families come in excited every week with their kids, and you get how many conversations you have about, you know, what food's supposed to taste like, based on, you know, what it should taste like, rather than what we've come to accept. And it's a travesty. And there's really, you know, what the way you get around that and what you do to combat that is start to grow your own food, make a connection with your farmer. The dinner that my wife cooked me before I came to speak on the show was from the CSA and from our garden. You know, our tomatoes just turned, and we got a container garden. We got pine trees in our lot that we're looking to get taken out, so we're kind of blocked on what we can put together. But, you know, we have a pretty significant container garden, and the whole dinner was from, you know, a local farmer and from what we grew. And that's a tremendously satisfying thing to have to be able to accomplish.
Yeah, and one thing you said about families coming out and getting the kids involved, you know, I think that's the key for the next generation, is to have them get involved with their food, learn about growing food, and it's a good way to combat, you know, the advertisement and, you know, all the junk food that's on television and stuff. And so many kids don't even know what a tomato looks like, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. You know that show that I haven't had a TV for over a year now, I'm proud to say, but last season, that Jamie Oliver show. Did you see that episode?
Yeah,
where
he pulled
the potato up, and I mean, that's just outrageous, isn't it? I mean, and the worst part was when they showed the kids how to make a chicken nugget, and then all they did was create the form of the chicken nugget and bread it to make it look like a chicken nugget, and all the kids wanted to eat it, you know. And
that was
horrible. It's just amazing how powerful it really was. It's so amazing how powerful those things are.
Yeah, they saw it. The kids watched him blend that chicken carcass in the blender and then mash it through a sieve, and they still wanted to eat what came out at the other end.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So you stated it. That's the impetus for starting your own garden, right? It's to really know what real food tastes like, because we can't get that anymore unless you go to a CSA and you know your farmer.
Right, Right. And you know, that is absolutely the key. And, you know, one of the things that we're trying to spearhead locally, we've got a lawn care company as well. It's called A Natural Approach. And, you know, we're kind of battling the aesthetic aspect of lawns because, you know, people, they don't want weeds in their lawns. And, you know, to a certain extent, we're not on a soapbox trying to denigrate anyone. But I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but there's 10 times the amount of irrigated land and lawns as there are to the next largest crop, which is corn. There's something like 100 million acres in the U.S. in irrigated lawn. So, you know, all of this propaganda in regards to genetically modified foods saying, well, we need to produce more food on the farmland we have, it's all rubbish. You know, I mean, we've got plenty of space if we just allocated it correctly. So, you know, one of the things that we've been thinking about transitioning into is rather than trying to, you know, well, two things. One, rather than trying to deal head-to-head with a chemical company who's got an herbicide that can make the weed go away tomorrow, and you forget the long-term approach, but that satisfies many people. We've been thinking about actually trying to work through these lawn care companies instead of going to the individual. And one of the programs that we're looking to implement is the idea of really utilizing lawns in a co-op fashion to grow food locally for different value-added markets. You know, we've worked with some people in terms of, you know, producing. You know, I know of a story about a cherry farmer in Oregon, and I think it was a 15-acre operation, and they were doing $250,000 a year in revenue in the cherries that they were selling. And they enhanced the nutritional program, balanced the soil, brought in compost teas, and really made sense of the scenario, and ended up selling $2.5 million of the same amount of cherries off of that 15 acres. And unfortunately, most of the good food that's grown in this country doesn't make it to a plate. It's actually sold to nutritional supplements and different things like that. But that arena is changing quite significantly as people wake up to conscious food, nutrient-dense food. So really the future of food should be, and in my opinion will be, designed around the nutrient density of the food. I mean, imagine if you could go to a supermarket and you could evaluate a tomato that had 20% higher amino acid content and 10% more calcium and on down the line, and you could see that for what it was. That would justify most people's dollar. Whereas if you call it organic and, you know, the conventional one looks exactly the same next to it, that's a much tougher sell, you know. So if we can really start to think about food in that way and then take it to a local market, and, you know, what's to say I couldn't hire 20 people in my town to grow Thai chilies for the Thai restaurants in town? You know, and you know, evaluate a business model where the Thai restaurants give you a price point. You help those local farmers with their yards, either do it for them or help them do it. Allow, you know, be able to sell them the system to do it, and then actually sell the produce for them. So it's just kind of a co-op that not only brings people together communally, but really makes sense of better food and makes it cheaper. I mean, one of the most amazing things about getting involved with this farmer, we've been working that does a CSA through a retail store. We've been working with him for maybe 4 or 5 years. He's been going through an organic transition for his land, and he used to be a conventional farmer, and he's really got a good head on his shoulders, and he's humble to it. And you know, you meet a lot of farmers that are very resistant to change. So being able to have a model like that and come in and say, all right, I know that you're resistant to change. On a certain level, I can't blame you, because if things don't go right, you don't have a savings account. I mean, farmers are forced to run on the most ridiculously small margins you've ever seen. So, you know, we could actually pay that farmer, you know, 50% higher salary year one and guarantee him through a model like that, where you have these markets that are willing to buy it. And not only businesses, but people. I mean, people that are knowledgeable of this stuff or that are busy. I mean, and that's a reality we have to deal with, is that everybody's so busy, it's hard to be a farmer. You know, but people are willing to pay for these kinds of things. So if you can really create a model where they can have access to that, guarantee that price point, and then build the model to grow it locally around them. You know, and what made me start talking about that was the farmer, and he's telling me the only way that he can really make it as an organic farmer is to do a CSA, because he makes so much more revenue in terms of selling it for $25 for a buck. He's skipping all the middlemen. And the best part about it is the consumer actually pays less for the food that they're getting as well. So it's kind of a win-win-win-win. And, you know, you just have to kind of think about that model, be serious about it, and invest in it in every way that you can. And I just, you know, I guess to finish that point, the most important aspect of all of that is people's awareness of how important it is, and then really using their buying power to support that. Because, I'm sure you guys have seen the movie Food, Inc., and I saw it when
right.
it came out.
Right.
One of the most poignant parts to that movie was the segment with the Walmart buyer that was at the farm, and he shot it straight. We can sit here and blame Walmart for our problems all day, but the reality is people buy the stuff from them to make them what they are, and the Walmart guy pretty much said, we wouldn't have it if people didn't buy it. And so, the reality is if everybody bought their intentions, everything would change tomorrow. And that's
right.
a really important thing for people to remember.
I think
Evan,
we have a call.
Yeah, go ahead, Carol.
Do we have a call? I think we have a caller on the line. Do we have someone there?
Hello? Is this Carol?
Hello.
Hey, Carol.
Yeah.
Who's this?
Hi, this is Barb with Farm Wars.
Oh.
Hi, Barb.
Hey, Barb. How's it going?
Hi. Oh, pretty good. Hey, I'm really interested in the topic you've got going. Have a question for Evan.
Sure.
If you don't mind. I have got, what I'm starting to do this year is I'm really supporting exactly what you're doing. I mean, it's just so right up my alley. It's funny. But I've started an indoor garden in my spare bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I have picked produce that I cannot grow in the outside garden. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions or anything for starting that up.
Yeah. It helped to know a little bit about how you have it set up. Have you started the garden yet, or are you just thinking about designing it and getting it into play?
Well, we've actually built a stand. And I've got a couple of shelves, actually three shelves on it right now. I've got a grow light, but I'm thinking that I need to put a grow light under each shelf to get direct light to the produce. I've just got through planting this morning 72 tomato plants on the seeds.
Wow.
And I have some green, actually red bell peppers, and we've got approximately 35 of those. And those are
wow.
nice big sprouts. They're coming up really, really nice. I just transplanted them. And now it's a matter of expanding the indoor room to where I need to have it and putting grow lights where I need to have them. Do I need to put these grow lights like directly above them? Will one work, or what do you think on that?
Yeah, one more question. What kind of grow light do you have? Is it a high-pressure sodium or a metal halide or a fluorescent or –
I think it's a fluorescent. Yeah, I
okay.
just went into the nearest Bi-Mart and got a grow light.
Gotcha. Okay. One of the things to really pay attention to is, if you go into a big box store, and it's really easy to put a ceiling fluorescent in a grow light box
mm-hmm.
and call it a grow light.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems with fluorescents is there's actually different types of fluorescents, like the big fat tubes that you see, they're 40-watt
mm-hmm.
ceiling tubes that you see in businesses and things like that. Those are called T12 lamps. And the compact fluorescents, the curlicue kind of lights, are called T8 fluorescents. And they have now what's called a T5 fluorescent. The T number is basically a gauge of how thick the tube is. So the more pressure you put the gas under in the tube, the more light you get per watt coming out of it. So unless you're working with a T5 fluorescent light, you're really not getting the efficiency out of it to really make what you're doing cost effective. So I would ask you to evaluate that first. On a larger area, I'm assuming you have maybe like a 12 by 8, 12 by 12 bedroom. Is that about right?
Yes, it's about a 10 by 10.
Okay, all right. Well, the best way to approach that, especially with plants that like heavy light, like tomatoes and peppers and that kind of thing, is to think about what's called an HID light. You have different categories of light. HID means high intensity discharge, and that encapsulates a metal halide or a high pressure sodium. So think a billboard light or a stadium light. So they're really intense lights. When you're working with a light like that, you don't bring the light directly on top of the plant because it actually physically will burn the plant. So you want to keep about 18 to 24 inches away from the canopy. With the T5 fluorescents, it's the same. It can get kind of confusing, so I don't want to confuse it. But you can get the same amount of light coming out of the fixture. It's just not as intense.
Mm-hmm.
So with a T5 fluorescent, you can actually bring it right down on the canopy. The limitation to the fluorescent, because of the lack of the intensity of the light coming out, it doesn't cover a space very well. So if you've got a 4-foot fixture, with, say, 8 T5 lamps in it, it's going to burn about 430 watts, somewhere in there. That would be the equivalent in terms of the light output of a 400-watt metal halide or high-pressure sodium. But you're really only going to be able to grow under the footprint of the fixture itself. With an HID light, a metal halide or high-pressure sodium, you can actually raise it up. And because of the intensity, the light will actually penetrate and cover a larger area. And then what you can do, and so having said that, I would recommend an HID based on what you're explaining with a larger space. Otherwise, you're going to be buying so many fluorescent fixtures, it just wouldn't make sense not to buy the HID. And then what you can also do, if you wanted to look into it, is look into a light mover. And you can just put that into a search engine, you know, HID lights and light mover. And what they are is just a 6-foot rail that has a motor that runs the length of the light, the rail. And then at the end of each side, it pauses for a minute. So you can imagine if the light was just going back and forth, the middle of the garden would get twice as much as the edges. So because it pauses at each end, it actually saturates in an equal amount of light across that 6-foot range. So rather than buying two HID fixtures, you can actually buy one to cover the same amount of space and cut costs in that way. And if you set up, you know, two HID lights on light movers in that room, you could pretty much max out your floor space and grow pretty much whatever you wanted.
Oh, wow.
How much would that kind of setup run, Evan?
Well, if you wanted to go with like a light and a mover, and that would probably be about maybe, you know, say like a 10 by 6 space, 10 by somewhere in there, 8 by 6 somewhere in there. You know, you're looking at probably around $600-$700. If you really dial it in, which is really recommended in the long term, you don't have to do this up front. I mean, one of the things that we like to help people with in designing grow rooms is really take it all the way to the end and what you want to do, and then work backwards in terms of what you purchase. Because what you can do is, if you get a lot of little small fixtures, they end up being a lot less efficient than buying one larger fixture and eating the upfront cost and saving money in the long run. Because, you know, you really have to factor in your electrical cost. A 1,000-watt light over the course of a month runs, say, 14 hours a day is going to be about $30, $35 a month. But you could get fluorescent fixtures that cost you half as much but cost $100 a month. And you could imagine in, you know, 2 or 3 months you've already turned yourself on its head. So it's really important to think through. Yeah, it really, really does. So, you know, another good idea, though, is these grow tents that are out there. That trying to think. Sun Hut's a name for one of them, but they're a zippered hut that actually has reflective material all around in the inside, and they've been plumbed so that you can hang the light fixtures easily, and they've got openings to allow ventilation. And that's really the last piece of the puzzle, is that, you know, if you have a bedroom and you have the door closed and you don't have proper air ventilation coming in or going out, depending on how you have it set up, you get stagnant air, and the plants use the CO2 available, and the CO2 becomes deficient in the air, and then photosynthesis can't occur. So you really need to – the best way to do it is to set it up, you know, just like a bathroom fan. You know, you turn it on, and it's sucking air out of the room. Well, when you remove air from the bathroom, air – you can't make a vacuum outside of a lab, you know. So – say under the door, air comes in from under the door, and that's the way it refreshes the air. And what it also does is, when you have an HID light, especially, fluorescents aren't as bad, but HID lights do produce an element of heat. So that heat can actually be used in winter climates and during winter seasons creatively. But when you remove,
that's
say, 100-degree air, yeah, I mean, that's the way to think about it, absolutely. And it's kind of a cool project because you can kind of keep getting better and better and more efficient, and that's the way to challenge yourself for sure. But, you know, if you're removing that 90-degree air from your room and 70-degree air from your house is coming in, it's really only a matter of how much air you need to move to keep it the temperature you want. And then what you could even do is put your fan on a thermostat, set 80 degrees, and every time the room hits 80 degrees, the fan comes on, and it removes hot air, and the fresh air with this cooler comes in and maintains your temperature. And that's really how you create an indoor environment. Otherwise, you know, you get temperatures that start to affect your plant growth and things of that nature. So, you know, the ventilation is important. It's absolutely not vital to make it work enough to really give you an experience with it. But if you really want to dial it in and get the most out of your plants, yeah, you really need to pay attention to the ventilation.
That's great.
Excellent. Thank you.
Do you
very well,
Barb? If you have any other questions, you're welcome to stay on the line. We're going to take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. So we'll be right back, and we'll see you on the other side.
experiencing anxiety, anger, depression, or low self-esteem? Do you beat yourself up or sabotage what you truly want to achieve? Hi, this is Jeannie Smith, and at Open Heart Healing, I combine counseling, Gestalt therapy, and Tai Chi energy work to assist those who truly desire to bring quality and joy back into their lives. My office is located on South Perry Street here in Castle Rock. Call me for a free consultation at 303-660-6373. Again, that's 303-660-6373, or visit me at openhearthealing.com.
Linda Masterson, Soul Purpose Astrologer, works with astrological tools and with guides in the non-physical to assist ones in knowing their soul purpose. Important in this process is identification of significant blockages. In each session, tools are provided for working with self to clear resistance and free talents, skills, and abilities to fuller expression. The goal is to take responsibility for and to accelerate the healing process. Phone sessions are offered by Linda. Please visit Linda at lindamasterson.com or call 808-651-0307. Again, that's 808-651-0307. This is Carol again, and I just wanted to talk to you about one of our new sponsors, Hole in the Wall Herb and Vitamin Shop up in Woodland Park. The owners, Mark and Nancy Duvall, are not only close personal friends, but they're also my nutritional gurus. They are now selling, teaching, and doing Asyra bioenergetic testing on their clients. I had this done, and I found out all my food allergies, emotional stressors, environmental sensitivities, hormonal balance, and I received a customized homeopathic remedy. Please call them for more information at 1-800-437-3240.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now. We are talking about growing your own food in harmony with nature with Evan Folds. Barb Peterson was just the caller on the last segment, and she's no longer on the line, but she's been a past guest on some other shows, and she has a great website. Thanks for your call, Barbara. Her website is Farm Wars, and you can get to it at farmwars.info. So, Evan, why don't you go ahead and give your website for our listeners so they can go check it out.
Yeah, thanks. It's progressearth.com.
Great. Get on there and check it out. There's some really interesting products on there. The Vortex Brewer is something that I find particularly intriguing. It's a compost tea maker, and it incorporates a vortex circulation. We talk about that a little.
Yeah. It was invented by Steve Storch, the farmer that I referenced earlier, and it was really born of really inspiration from biodynamics from Rudolf Steiner and from a man called Victor Schauberger, named Victor Schauberger, I should say. He was actually known as the Water Wizard, and his insight. He was a forester in Austria, and he spent many years of his life out in the woods and in virgin woods that had never been touched by modern society and deforestation, these types of things. And he witnessed many phenomena, rocks floating in rivers and, the different aspect of fish climbing up waterfalls and vortices and how they apply to nature. And he intuited the power of implosive energy. And if you think about how we collectively use energy in modern society, it's all explosive. You have internal combustion engines, nuclear energy. These are very, very destructive processes that with very low energy transfers. They're very inefficient. And nature doesn't work like that. Nature actually regenerates life, and it works by implosion, not explosion. So, implosion is regenerative, explosion is destructive. It's a pretty simple concept. And what the Vortex Brewer does is it really allows water that implosive moment. You know, why a river meanders in nature. Water wants to fold on itself, a wave crashing on a beach, a raindrop spiraling as it falls. All of these methods actually create living water and allow water to carry out its most important role in nature. I mean, we tend to think of it materialistically as hydration, and while that's important, the real role of water is to communicate subtle energies. So it's kind of, you know, the meander in a river is, you know, a way to think about it. It's kind of how the beginning of the river talks to the end of it, and vice versa. And, you know, there's many instances in the Danube River and the Rhine River over in Europe that they've straightened the river, you know, to make it more navigable, for example, and it results in tremendous fish kills and erosion and, you know, all of these issues. And you know, there's not a smoking gun there, but the reality of it is you've really created degeneration in that living system. So what the Vortex Brewer allows you to do is really work with living water. You know, a way that we like to frame it is, you know, we don't make a vortex, we allow it. And that's true. You know, water wants to move in this way if you allow it. So, you know, allowing the water to have an implosive moment exposes it, makes it vulnerable to the energies that are associated with it. So if you look into biodynamics, Steiner taught that, you know, when you stir the preps to create a field spray, you can imagine putting your hand in a bucket and stirring it. Well, that bucket solution will hug the edges. It's an explosive vortex. And it's when you reverse the flow that the chaos creates millions of implosive vortices. And it's at that moment where water becomes vulnerable to what you've put into it. And that allows you to use a tablespoon of a biodynamic compost to an acre of land. So it operates homeopathically. If people out there are familiar with homeopathy, it's really, you know, when you take a concentrate and to simplify it, you really dilute the concentrate out of the solution molecularly. So you're not even dealing with the physical substance you started with, but the water carries out the medicinal effect in terms of the medical aspects of homeopathy. So biodynamics is really homeopathic farming. And the Vortex Brewer is a biodynamic stirring machine. It's also a mixing machine, just simply to run your nutrients for your garden through it, even outside of a biological context. And then as you referenced, it's also a compost tea brewer, which is really, you know, compost tea, and a simple way of putting it is really growing microorganisms. So, you know, a way to kind of frame it for people is to think about an aquarium. Many people have had aquariums, and, you know, you aerate the water so the fish can breathe. Well, you do the same thing for the microbes. And the Vortex Brewer doesn't use water pumps to create the circulation. It actually uses air. And, you know, imagine blowing bubbles in a full glass of water. Well, the air that you're infusing moves the water up, which encourages the drain, and the water just tumbles on itself and organizes into a vortex. So there's no filters or water pumps or anything. It's a totally unimpeded circulation. So when you present finished compost, you know, when you throw a banana peel in a compost pile, the organisms digest it into plant food, what's called humus. So when you have a finished compost, all of the microbes involved are asleep. They've already digested everything. They don't have anything else to eat. So you put that sleeping compost in the brewer, and the oxygen is going to wake them up, the oxygen you're diffusing from the air that you're infusing. And then you present those organisms that are enlivened with a food source, like molasses or kelp or fish emulsion or fat guano or something along those lines. And in the presence of oxygen and a food source, the microbes grow to really, really high concentrations. So it can sound complicated, primarily because most of what we learn about microbes is use hand sanitizer, you know, but the reality is microbes are what create soil. They're also what protect plants from disease. I mean, in reality, the diseases on your plants are really just microbes with nothing to eat them. And so kind of a really simple way to think about it is think about the big fish and the little fish in the ocean, or the lions and the zebras on the prairie, you know, on the plains. You know, it's really about balance. And when you create biological balance, you don't have pest infestations and diseases and, you know, these kinds of things, that, and even weeds for that matter. Many weeds are really an indication of the imbalances biologically and minerally in soil. They're not just a thorn in our side. So, again, you can kind of see how the perspective of these things is so important. You know, if you take a pest infestation, they all have antennae on their head. Well, they don't have antennae for nothing. It's exactly a guy named Dr. Phil Callahan that spent his life researching this. He's an entomologist, and he determined that pests are actually attracted to unhealthy plants through infrared vibrations. And this stuff is real and documented. It's just not out front. But, you know, if you kind of come to that conclusion yourself and see the truth in it, and even better, have an experience and let it play through, well, then your inclination is not to go out and try to murder all the pests on your plants, because you realize you're just creating more of a problem for yourself. So, you know, again, it's not about an act, so to speak. It's about the concept, and we can come to that conceptual conclusion. Things like the vortex brewer make even more sense.
Wow, that's even more amazing than I realized it was. we've had a guest on the show talking about homeopathy, Mark Duvall. For the fans of our archives, you can go check that out. Go to our website, foodintegritynow.org, and type Mark Duvall in the search box in the upper left. It's certainly a fascinating field, and wow, the vortex brewer. So, we'd love to get more into that. I understand it's going to be, but I'd still like to give a little bit more of a foundation for people that just want to get started, say with some wheatgrass. But before we get into that, the vortex brewer is right now, it's mostly for commercial purposes, but I understand you're coming out with a model that's more for the consumer.
Yeah, we are. It's we're going to call it Vortex Junior. And it, basically, it's just a stripped-down version that's trying to meet a more reasonable price point for a backyard gardener. Because most of where we came from this was, you know, larger farmers and landscapers, and the price points that we have on the – we have a 15-gallon unit, a 30-gallon unit, 85, 250. We can make them up to 10,000 gallons. So, you know, they can tend to price the average gardener out. In an effort of really making this accessible to everyone, we're hopefully no more than 2 or 3 weeks away from being able to launch it. And if you did want more information and you wanted to stay in touch, you can actually just go to vortexbrewer.com, and there's a capture page on that homepage where you can just put your information in, and we'll actually send you emails every 2 or 3 days on information such as what we're talking about now, and it'll allow us to stay in touch. But yeah, we're really excited about that because it's really about meeting people where they are, you know, and that's one thing that we're trying to put a whole lot of focus on.
Great. So let's say I'm sure there's some people out there that don't have a garden right now and want to get their feet wet, and say wheatgrass is a good place to start, right? So you know, what do you suggest? What do they need to get started just to go out and get a little wheatgrass tray going?
Yeah, well, you know, the wheatgrass kit that we distribute is really a result of me figuring out how to do it at my house. So it's not complicated really at all. It involves, you know, the way that and there's not really a correct way to do it, so to speak. You know, we kind of try to give you a platform and then invite you to be creative and make it work for how you're doing it and your situation. But really it involves just some seed flats, just the black 10x20 seed flats. I recommend getting one with holes and one without so that you can water the wheatgrass from the bottom. It's important to keep the top of the growing media or the soil, whatever you choose to use, dry as you can, because it can encourage molds to grow if it's not. Kind of need some good air movement in your home. Generally, any kind of central air house would have adequate air movement. And past that, it's really, you know, either some potting soil and the wheat berries. You can get wheat berries is just a fancy way of saying wheat seed. And traditionally, what you'd want to use, what's normally used for wheatgrass, is the hard red winter wheat. And most health food stores have that bulk. And most health foods have it bulk in an organic grain, which, you know, obviously is important to, you know, we were picking on organics earlier, but it's a lot better than nothing because you can pretty much guarantee anything that's not organic has multiple forms of pesticides on it. Unfortunately, organics is kind of creeping into that realm as well, but it is a lot better than conventional. So if you can seek out some organic wheat berries, and if you wanted to get in touch with us, I could actually email you the instructions to the kit just to give you a primer on how to do that. I'd be happy to do that. Just send us an email. We'd be happy to get back to you. And it's really, you know, to kind of simplify it in a 30-second explanation, you soak the wheat berries for a day. You let them dry for a day, and the root tip will burst. You then, once you have that process done, you put your soil or your growing media. You could use core fiber or some other kind of growing media in the seed flat. You sow the wheat berries that have germinated onto the growing medium, and I'd recommend getting a humidity dome to retain the humidity. The vulnerable part of the process is when the root has burst and there's not a green growth yet, because that's the point where the root's got to grow down into the growing media. So either you're going to water it 2 or 3 times a day, and most people aren't home to do that, or you get a little humidity dome. And then once the roots have reached down into the water that you're feeding it from the bottom, it's really just a matter of watering it 1 or 2 days. And 10 days later, you got 8 to 10 inch long wheatgrass. You cut it like hair and then run it through preferably a masticating juicer that doesn't heat up. which is really important. Not if you heat something higher than 115 degrees, it denatures all of the life force, all of the enzymes that we were discussing earlier. So that's kind of the rationale of raw foods, is that if you can eat food that hasn't had the enzymes denatured, the food actually helps you digest it. When you cook food, it actually puts all the responsibility on your body to digest that food, and that's really making your body go into overdrive and work harder than it needs to. So that's really all there is to it. It's really not a complicated process. It's more about just getting in a rhythm and trying to treat it like brushing your teeth in the morning.
So what's your email address for people that want to contact you?
Yeah, you can send an email to contact@progressearth.com, and you can find that on our website at progressearth.com. And, you know, like I said, just inquire, ask them for some wheatgrass instructions, and we'll get back to you with a PDF of the instructions and some frequently asked questions. And that's a really good place to start, because once you get that experience of what it feels like to really get living food back in your diet, there's really no turning back.
Oh, that sounds great. I'm probably going to start one of those myself.
I'm going to hold you to it.
All right. So this is the, like we said before, this is the first in a series with Evan Folds. We just barely touched on all the topics and plethora of information that Evan clearly has to offer on this topic. So we invite you, for all of you out there looking to start your own gardens and grow your own food, to send us your questions at info@foodintegritynow.org, or you can post it on our wall on our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/fintegrity, and go ahead and post any questions you have for Evan there. Topics that we're thinking about are doing going further into hydroponics and grow rooms, and also preparing soil for those that do have garden areas. What is fertile soil? How do you test it? What do you need to grow? And so hopefully we can provide some good information and spread the goal that Evan is embodying in Progress Earth.
And we've talked a lot on this show about you know, the problems with our food supply, the GMOs and the pesticides and chemtrails and all of that. So I think this is going to be a really good series to assist many who want to take responsibility for their food and not just rely on going to the grocery store and maybe getting organics if it says organics, but maybe not. To know what's in your food more and to just take more responsibility for yourself.
Yeah, I really commend you guys for what you're doing. You know, I've looked into some of your archives, and it's so important to know the why, you know, and really to challenge yourself to really figure out what we've gotten ourselves into. But it's equally as important, as you said, to really know about the how, you know, and how to get into moving towards making some sense of it, because unfortunately,
yeah,
you can get depressed really quick when you start making a sober allocation of what it is that's out there in regards to fluoridation and chemtrails and GMOs,
yeah,
and these things. But there really is something that you can do about it, and it starts with, you know, with what you buy in a store, you know, and where you get
right.
it from. Because there's people out there paying attention. They're just not on the front page of the news and on the nightly news,
right,
unfortunately. So
right.
I commend you all for what you're doing, and I really appreciate you letting me be here.
Thank you so much, and I think we only have like 20 seconds left. So, Matt, do you want to give out our website information and all that before we sign off?
Yeah, go ahead. And we actually have a minute left, I think. But go ahead and check us out at foodintegritynow.org. We've got some good articles on there. And be sure to check out Evan's website at progressearth.com. And make sure to let us know what you want in this series. And stay tuned for show announcements. You can go to our Facebook page, and you can be up to date on what is coming up. So we want to thank you, Evan, for coming on the show, and
yeah,
we certainly look forward to the next time. And yeah, it's springtime, big growing season, and you know, lots of stuff growing out there, and it's about time to grow your own food. And we're really appreciative.
I started my tomatoes yesterday, and, you know, it's a little scary for me, too. I've never really grown my own food. I had a garden when I was growing up, but, you know, wasn't really that involved in it, and I'm really excited. So thanks again, and we are Food Integrity Now, and we will be back on next week. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.